Thank you, Lee. I am Dr. John Galbraith from Virginia Tech. I'm a podologist. I study soil genesis, and I particularly enjoy studying genesis in wetland systems. So today we'll talk about rapid genesis. How long does it take to form soil structure or to modify soil structure in created wetlands? We'll look at carbon-rich horizons and also redoxomorphic features. So just as a background, on newly constructed wetlands, we're typically talking about systems that are low in organic carbon, are high in pH, higher than at least the reference wetlands. They have higher density, often due to compaction. They have poor structure, also due to compaction and removal of topsoil layers, even if they're replaced. And then very few redoxomorphic features relative to nearby reference wetlands. So we're dealing with those issues. So we're looking for the formation of these features. How long does it take? Well, the variables here can be time, texture, vegetation type, litter quality, construction practice. How about the presence or absence of iron? We believe the length of time required is understudied, and so we looked into it a little bit closer. Now, bright red pore linings are things that I observed forming in just a few weeks' time, 6 weeks, in a ponded system where I had gone out and tilled the wetland soil and destroyed all structure. It ponded for a few weeks, maybe 2 weeks, and then it dried up. I went back out 6 weeks later and was digging and found that all of the pores that had formed were filled with blood red redox concentrations. And Chris showed a picture of something very similar in his presentation. And so I think that we also observed that in a clayey wetland and all. That can happen fairly rapidly, 6 weeks. It's empirical evidence. I didn't study it. Angie Cummings found that oxidized rhizospheres can form within 5 years, and Mike Vapraskis and his partners also saw redox features forming in less than or within 3 years in various created wetlands. So we're talking about features in created wetlands here. But how quickly do redox concentrations form in sandy created wetlands where there may not be a source of iron? How quickly do older redox concentrations that are exposed in created wetlands go away? In other words, if you remove several feet of old marine terrace or stream terrace deposits and you get down into a layer that has redox features that formed under a different hydrologic regime, do those redox features stay there or do they go away? And if so, how long does it take? So for soil structure, we know that created wetlands also have a higher density and typically have massive or platy structure near the surface, and especially if they're finer textured, and that's due to the compression weight of the machinery that's used to move the soil around. And this was found by numerous investigators, including some of Rob Brooks's partners. The soil structure should form in created wetlands if organic matter and clay are present to stabilize the ped surfaces, but if it's compacted, they should form more slowly. And then for carbon, we think that they can form relatively quickly due to high pH, high organic matter inputs, wet, ponded, lower detritivore. All of these things lower decomposition rates, and this was found by a couple of different studies. So if you can lower decomposition rates, you can build up organic matter quickly. Now, that's found in several studies. On the other hand, and we saw that by the asymptotic curves that Jacob and Chris showed in their data that they presented earlier this morning. But in contrast, we've also seen systems that did not seem to build up carbon much below a few centimeters of the surface. And again, Chris also had a study that I believe showed that there wasn't or that we reached a leveling off point fairly rapidly. So what happens to these systems? You can form carbon in a few years, but several studies found that it did not continue to accumulate at the same rate after the first few years of time. So our objectives were to look at a few two different constructed wetlands in eastern Virginia, just east of the fall line on coastal plain, marine terraces or river terraces. And we looked at them in 3 and 11 years later to determine the minimum time for alteration. Here's a study at the Wayanak Wetland, also known as the Shirley Wetland. It's on the Shirley Plantation. It's a tidal, freshwater, sandy created wetland. And this was constructed back about 11 years earlier, and we visited it recently. And essentially it was created to recreate a bottomland hardwood. It is a flooded system. It is tidally flooded, and it is flooded by high events on the James River itself. It's sandy dredged material that came out of the bottom of the river, but also topsoil, loamy soil was put in place at the same level as the sandy excavated surface in order to determine the effect of texture. So we'll go in sequence here from pictures A, B, C to D. And here's the site. This was the essentially an upland created by dredging the wetland and piling it up, planting it to a type of grass that could withstand droughty conditions and letting it go. Years later, Charles Carter and Lee Daniels partnered up with some others to investigate what would happen if you excavated down to the tidal level of the James. And so in picture B, you can see where about 4 feet of this sand was removed. And picture C, maybe 5, 6, 7 years later, you can see the vegetation starting to recover, and it was planted as a mitigation site. But there were also many volunteer species brought in by tidal action. And in D, you can see me trying to work my way in between the red maple and slippery elm saplings that have come in on the site. This is the original soil, and what I can tell you that it's redox-free. Sandy material, brown-colored. We imposed 5 treatments on the site, and 2 are essentially control, one that's sandy and one that had loamy topsoil inset. The others have combinations of composts that are added. The sites were tilled, and these rates are based on wet weights here. It's described several times over the next few years. So again, this picture on the left shows the sand. It appears to have some colored patterns, but that's really just dry sand versus moist sand. I smeared it out and took a quick picture and all, but there's no redox features in this whatsoever. The sand treatment with some compost on top, you can see in the center picture, the compost has darkened the surface considerably, lowered the value and the chroma, and then you can see that the subsoil actually has a glade matrix, or a depleted matrix, excuse me, is what it would qualify for. The picture on the right shows the loamy inset, and you can see where the contact is between the loamy material and the sandy material by that line of red redoxomorphic features there. Okay, we found that the redox features found in the sandy materials within 3 years in half the plots. Even though you don't see darkening at the surface here, this would be one where some compost was added, but it evidently quickly decomposed. But what it did was it generated microbial activity. All of these sandy plots had redox features within 25 centimeters of the surface. Now recall that this is not limited by hydrology. This area is tidally flooded twice a day, all year long, and then covered with enormous storm events as well. The carbon in the sand surface, not in this particular picture, but in general, went from 2%, 0.2% to 0.5%, and then it jumped dramatically. I believe it's going to start leveling off. One thing about this tidal system, though, is it brings in floating organic debris, and you have huge amounts of vegetation out there adding to the original compost that was added to the treatment. So, but we have distinct concentrations and depletions in the loamy material, and again, you can see a depleted matrix formed below the surface here. This is a picture of one of the compost treatments here, and here you can see where the compost is still in place. You can also, I believe, see some ferrohydrite on the water surface in the pit right next to the plug, and you can also see some redoxamorphic features, and these are distinct, even though they don't show up so well in this picture. But that was found on approximately two-thirds of the plots just after a few years. So this is, again, just a quick comparison and all. In 2003, no depletions or concentrations. After 3.5-4 years, we went back again. And in the treatment that had no compost, interestingly, had quite a few redox concentrations, as did the one that had a small amount of compost added. Some of them didn't show much difference. But in general, on average, about, you know, less than or equal to 20% concentrations forming and less than or equal to about 5% depletions. And you'll notice after 11 years, then some of the treatments, again, 0%, 1% depletions, 0% depletions. Why aren't we getting reduction in these situations? Well, we did. Between 2003 and 2007, you actually went from a 10YR 5-4 matrix to a 2.5YR 5-2 matrix. And so they're not showing up as depletions, but they're showing up in the form of a depleted matrix. All right. And again, the concentrations increased over time. So we do have an iron source in that sand, which is important, and also in the water from the James River. Okay. All right, the structure began as either described as single-grained or massive. It then, after 4 years, was described as weak granular or subangular, but mainly granular. And then a few years later, 7 years later, moderate subangular blocky structure. Now, how can you do that in a sand texture? Not all of these had sand surfaces. Treatments 4 and 5 had that loamy surface, so that's not surprising. But in the first three treatments that had a sand texture, it was the addition of the compost, I believe, with the addition of the silt that was coming in on the tidal action. So siltation, and you could feel an increase in silt. So as opposed to a sand texture as they were originally described, we feel like some of them now are loamy sands or even sandy loams. And change in surface value went from fives and sometimes sixes as originally described. They dropped down one value after 4 years, and they dropped down 2 to 3 values after 11 years. So, again, the concentrations formed just below the surface. I didn't see any in the surface, but again, we had tidal hydrology, freshwater. We have new concentrations as orange and red root zone rhizospheres and then some masses. And the masses formed more so in the sandy materials in the loamy topsoil. It was more along pore surfaces and ped surfaces, and it interfaces with the sand. The depletions appeared and increased only slightly. However, the matrices became depleted after only 4 years of time. And the sandy soils developed the subangular blocky, again due to that silt enrichment and humus to add to that. And the topsoil plots had higher organic matters initially and developed redox features within 1 year. Now, this is the second wetland, and I don't have much of an introduction for that for the sake of time, but just looking at the different compost rates, these were calculated as dry. The rates were calculated based on the dry weight of the compost, but you can see the progression from left to right. And just look at the surface, the area below the topsoil. These were tilled. Then the first two treatments to the left, the clayey surface texture. This was an area where they excavated down to a clayey BTG horizon and then left it. There was very little topsoil movement after that, very little disturbance to the sites. We went out, added compost at different rates and tilled. But on the two compost rates to the right, the compost was so thick we actually couldn't reach the mineral material very easily. So the two to the left are ones that have quite a bit of mineral mixed in with the compost. But just look at the subsurface colors. You can see, again, those bright red colors in pores. But then as you get to the higher compost rates, you have higher microbial activity. These all have the same hydrology. And you can see the absence and removal and loss of not only the red oxidized matrix, but also the red redox features that were left over from when this site was 2.5 feet lower in the ground. So, again, we have the same features. The one thing that did happen was soil structure developed very well underneath the compost. It not only developed away from platy and massive and high-density structure from clay textures, we actually lost clay and developed loamy textures in just a short amount of time of 11 years. So I think that's pretty amazing and rapid soil genesis. And so we had organic carbon increases in there, but there may also be a point where we get decreases in carbon by adding high levels of compost, and eventually we'll probably get some losses back down to an equilibrium amount. So with that, here's a picture of the site now, of the clayey wetland with planted river birch and pin oaks in the background, and I'd like to express my appreciation to VDOT and Waynack Land Limited Partnership for the financial support, and Charles Carter, Lee Daniels, my partner, and like to know if there is time for questions. Thank you.
Okay, first let's handle questions for John, and then in sequence after that, if there are any other follow-up questions for the earlier speakers, leave that up. Okay.
May I add an addendum here? I'm shamelessly throwing a plug for poster number 2034. My graduate student, Emily Ott, will be presenting much more specific and detailed data about this research site. So if you have time, that poster will be up all week. Go by 2034, and you'll get more information than I was able to give. Mike?
Is there still time for a question?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
You focused on the redox features, which is fine, but hydric soils are identified by the field indicators, as you well know.
Correct.
Do you have any comments on how long it took to form field indicators?
Yes.
In this area, rather than just the redoxymorphic features?
Yes, and I'm sorry, Mike, I took some of that material out because to shorten the length of the presentation to meet the time limit here, but we did look for hydric soil indicators, and we met them after about 3 years and about half the plots, would you say, Lee? Even including on the sandy soils.
Which ones?
Okay, S5. Was the biggest one in the sandy soils, and we met F3 and F19 on the ones where loamy topsoil was in place, inset in the surface.
Okay. Right. Within 3 years?
Within 3 years on the S5 on about half the plots. After 11 years, all of the plots that we looked at made S5 or the F19 or the F3.
I just have a quick question. I was just wondering, what was your source of compost material that you were using? Was it similar to the typical riparian or vegetation structure that you had there on the site coming back?
I'm sorry, could you speak a little louder? I didn't quite hear that.
My question is what was your source of compost material that you used for the study?
The compost used on that site was a wood waste compost, mainly ground up woody waste and pallets. Was well composted, had a C-N of about 40 to 1, but it was a fairly very stable material. Yeah. So any other questions for John? Okay, thanks, John. Right. Now, since we do have some time here before the scheduled break, I'll go through sequentially, are there any questions for our first speaker, Jacob Berkowitz, about the federal perspective?
I was just wondering if you had any other soil indicators that you tried out or have worked with in your quick assessment approach?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. In the assessment method that I presented this morning, the only two rapid soil-specific parameters were the O horizon and A horizon thickness. Many of the other methods use kind of proxy measurements of soil integrity, cation exchange capacity, and other parameters like that, but again, they're really not direct measures of things like CEC. They're based on soil type and disturbance history to estimate those.
Are there any more questions for Jacob? Okay. Next would be, are there questions for Chris Kraft? All right. Next would be Mike Papraskis. Are there any questions about his?
Hi, Mike. I had a question about that complex table you had. You had dry, normal, wet, and I don't know if it was percent in the growing season or days in the growing season, but it seemed like the dry one had all the wells that were wet, and then there were a bunch of zeros in the wet year. I didn't understand how that was set up. It implied that you were meeting the hydrologic requirement in those dry rainfall events. Was that because of groundwater?
Okay, you're talking about the percent of the wells that met the wetland hydrology requirements. It gets a little complicated to explain. I'm not sure which of those years you're referring to, but the most difficult thing for me to understand, for example, was that 2010 year where half the wells met the requirement, half did not, roughly. And the reason is you have to be saturated primarily during the early part of the growing season. And that's where we were dry. Okay, so when I say dry, none of the wells passed the standard at that time. But later in the year, there were a few areas, particularly in the organic soils, where we hit a normal rainfall pattern and we started picking it up. So to explain that table, I have to almost go well by well with you. But I'm confident that the data are valid. And let me just turn to the guy that came up with the data. Thomas, do you have any more comments to add?
Yeah, that was, when I was looking at it, I didn't understand it at all either. And
we don't want that as your answer.
But in talking to Dr. Papraskis and a technician in the department who has worked a lot more with stuff like this. With the earlier years, even though most of the wells were, the 3 months of prior rainfall were dry, or drier than normal, the secret is that, or the trend was that they started at the very beginning of the growing season, which was March 25th, and continued in for the 29 or greater consecutive days. But like Dr. Papraskis said, in 2010, March and April were drier than usual, and so that trend of continuing over from having the wetter winter and the reduced water uptake by plants and everything, leading to the water table being within 30 centimeters, that reduced rainfall led to the water table dropping below, and so most of the wells that previously had been within that within the required distance of the surface, they weren't able to, once the normal rainfall resumed, to pick back up and meet the requirement. A lot of those, looking at them, I plotted them well by well, how many days, broke them up into ranges of how many days they were saturated for, and most of them were saturated for still 14 to 28 days, but we needed 29 to call it successful with this, so they didn't meet it. But
so it's a complicated answer. We'd have to actually go case by case to pin it out. We've checked it a number of times, and I'm pretty comfortable with those results.
So I'm still a little confused. I guess another question I would have to follow up on that is, when you have a wet spring, is it like a false positive then when you're looking at the data? I mean, because it looks like you're throwing out the data when you have a wet spring because you had all the zeros on there.
Right.
So
No. We're not throwing out anything.
Okay.
So I guess maybe I'm starting to understand what your question is.
It's the rainfall period.
These are the number of wells that met the standard.
Okay.
So if there's a zero there, no well met the standard in a wet period.
Okay.
I'd have to sit down and go over this with you. Apparently, I rushed through that table too fast. But if you add up that total percentage, 84%, there should have been numbers that add up to that within the three dry, normal, and wet rows. Okay?
Okay.
But if you have questions, I can explain it individually. I'll be willing to talk to you in detail. But it's the number of wells, actually, during that year that met the standard, and we just identified, was it during a dry, wet, or normal period? Okay?
More questions for Mike? All right. Last but not least, any follow-ups for Rich Whitaker on hydrology? Chris?
So, Rich, I enjoyed the talk, and like most people, I was surprised that you didn't say anything about clay being important as an impermeable layer. And so you say these big piles of sand can still perch that water table, and is that just it gets denser as the bulk density of this stuff get higher as you go down, or what's the factor that's keeping that water table up in those big piles?
It's a combination of those three things, the geometry of the setting, the permeability, and the ratio basically of the recharge and the permeability. That's really the key factor. This is an equation developed by Chuck Fetter in his early hydrogeology textbook, and I've never seen anybody really use this equation, but it's incredibly useful. And it's a very simple equation to calculate the shape of the water table, and it's really just based on those three things, the geometry of the island and the height that the water can build up, given how hard it is for the water to escape. So it has nothing to do with the stratigraphy. You don't have to back it up at all. We've seen cases where you try to look at this on very coarse sand barrier islands, and you don't get a mound at the surface. If it's a really fine sand, the water's up there. So it's really that ratio of how much water's coming in versus how the resistance going out. Fascinating equation.
Is there any other questions?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Back to that wet bud. Yes. Is that the name? How much experience do you need to use it? And the reason I ask is it looked fairly straightforward until Lee said it has a mod flow component.
Yes.
And in my brief experience, we had one student working with that. That's not something that anybody can just pick up right away.
What we're trying to do is to make a package, shall we say, so user-friendly that the regulators, or obviously mostly not engineers, we'll say this is great and ask the regulatory community to use it. That's our goal. So at this point, we've gotten something easy enough to use for our grad students, who essentially are researchers, and what we're now trying to do is to make it so simple to get to that level. But when the time comes, it certainly will be, let's put it this way, the basic version would certainly be very usable at that level. If you're trying to import AutoCAD files or a variety of other things that you have no idea how to use, you may not want to use those sorts of things, but we're trying to make it just as simple as possible for that, even with the mod flow. So depending upon how complicated you want to make it, I would say the simpler versions we could do with mod flow for most folks who don't have like an engineering background. If you really want to juice it up with all sorts of complications, you probably would want, just for input purposes, have a better background. So I think it's going to be available, useful for a wide range. Right now we have it beta testing with a variety of people. We had it sort of put on the streets about 6 months ago with a variety of folks, and frankly, most folks have said at this point, you got to get rid of the defaults. You're good right to the defaults and get rid of all the options, and then it'll make it a lot easier. So we're at that point and we're working.
Yeah, let me comment on that. We're fortunate we have a very talented programmer working with us. So he's got a really nice Windows-based interface for it. But the first version through was essentially full-blown. So it was expected you would have to, you know, populate, you know, KSATs, this and that, heads, everything. The version that he is working on now, and his name is Zach Adjutantis, and he fortunately recently left the University of Crete and moved to the University of Kentucky, so he's closer to us. The version that we're working on now, that we hope in a few months we can get tested, will have most of the settings for ModFlow for several standard designs set as defaults, such that you'll just zip on through. But as Rich said, if you really want to do a 3D design where you want to say this is the actual topography that I want to model, including flow through streams and micro depressions and everything like that, then that's going to take somebody with enough of a skill level to come out of CAD, drop in a CAD layer, and set a lot more defaults. The basic version, which doesn't account for things in 3D, it's essentially a 2D version, is not ModFlow based. And it'll be readily usable a lot quicker, let's put it that way. So, yeah.
And one more quick point to make it as user-friendly as possible. What we've done, essentially we've done a preprocessor and a post-processor with two different calculation schemes in the middle. And the preprocessors, Zach has been able to figure out how to go grab all of the weather data you need and populate your data set like that, which made us cry the first time we saw him do it for the months, you know, it took us to do it. And then to essentially pump out that one result at the end. So it's really, the preprocessor and post-processors are designed to be just as simple as possible. And it's got some real powerful pieces in it, and hopefully it'll be very simple to use.
Yeah,